In the wild highlands and war-torn plains of Central Asia lie tantalizing traces of the ancient world. Here, 2,300 years ago, Alexander the Great became the first European to rule the East. In an epic campaign, the ancient Greeks crushed the Persian Empire. It was a turning point in human history. Along the banks of the mighty Oxus River, Alexander discovered a highly developed Eastern civilization. My name is David Adams. I'm a photojournalist, and I want to explore the footprints of this ancient world, today almost entirely erased. This is my quest for Alexander's lost world. Alexander the Great set off from Greece to conquer the rich land of his Persian foe. His campaign would take him thousands of kilometers from his homeland across Afghanistan in Central Asia. I want to find out what the world looked like to Alexander. But this landscape today is radically different to the way it appeared in the time of the ancient Greeks. And I believe the reason is extreme climate change.
So this place was an inland waterway, and the Greeks, according to this theory, could have sailed right past here.
Today, remnants of the age when water connected these lands still survive. There's a glimmer of the extraordinary Oxus civilization that once thrived in these arid and barren lands. Great cities and trade routes first recorded by explorers that sailed on ancient seas. I'm starting my journey as Alexander the Great did in Greece. This is Volos Harbour, around 4 hours' drive from the modern capital today, Athens.
Now, if the crow flies, it's about 4,000 kilometres to Afghanistan. Now, in the time of Alexander the Great, that was the end of the world. But what's amazing about Alexander is that he wasn't the first to travel to the east.
The Greeks have been drawn to the east since the earliest of times. I want to see what connections there are to Alexander and who may have inspired him.
So the ancient Greeks were a pretty intrepid bunch. The trouble is, all those legends that surround their great voyages means that it's really hard to work out what actually happened. But behind some of them, there's an element of truth. And the most famous of them was Jason and the Argonauts.
Thanks to the government of Volos, we've been given use of their replica of Jason's celebrated boat, the Argo, to explore what truth lies behind Jason's fabled voyage. When Jason and his crew of Argonauts are thought to have set sail over 3,000 years ago, ships like this plied the Aegean Sea. Jason and the Argonauts is an ancient Greek myth, a tale passed down for millennia. The hero, Prince Jason, and his crew of Argonauts sailed across distant seas in search of the magical golden fleece. The fleece was a symbol of prosperity for his family and his kingdom.
Well, I guess by now you're wondering what Jason and the Argonauts has to do with Alexander the Great in Afghanistan. And if you accept the popularized version of the story, well, nothing at all. But there are far more ancient fragments that tell a very different journey for Jason. Now, if I'm right, this will shed some amazing light on where the legend came from and perhaps more importantly, where they went. And that's got everything to do with my quest for Alexander's lost world.
I think the origins of the Jason myth are based on real facts. I want to find out how the story of Jason and his Argonauts began. Our modern-day Jason, and captain of this Argo, is Babylos Stavros. Over the years, he and the Argonauts Rowing Club have sailed from one side of the Aegean Sea to the other. If you're going to explore the legend of Jason and the Argonauts, this is the crew to do it with. This Argo is a 50-oared war galley, what's known as a penteconter. Crafted by hand using Bronze Age tools and techniques, there's not a nail to be found anywhere along its 28-metre-long hull. In ancient times, versatile craft like this were used for long-range sea trade. The popular version of the Jason myth says that in 1263 BC, they set sail from Mycenae in Bronze Age Greece into the Aegean Sea. They crossed the Sea of Marmara and passed through the Bosphorus into the Black Sea, where they turned eastwards onto the land of the Golden Fleece, thought today to be in the Republic of Georgia. But this can't be right. There's no evidence that the Mycenaean Greeks ever sailed to Georgia. What's more, Georgia wasn't a major centre of gold production. That makes the idea of Georgia as the land of the Golden Fleece hard for me to believe.
Hey, up! Hey, up! Hey, up!
The oldest Greek versions of the story tell of a different route. And they hold a clue. The legendary Argonauts were heading far further than Georgia, to the remote east.
What they say is that they sailed out of the Black Sea into the ocean and then came around Africa back into the Mediterranean. What these guys are talking about is a journey out of the Black Sea, not to the Black Sea. Now, if you look at a map of the Black Sea today, there's only two ways out of it. One is the Danube, the other is the River Don. Now, both of those don't lead to any sea. So, was it back then somehow different? Was there a way that you could sail out of the Black Sea? Well, that's what we're going to find out.
One of the oldest versions of the story comes from the ancient Greek writer Homer. His epic poems suggest that thousands of years ago, the world looked very different to the way it looks today. Water levels were so much higher, the seas, lakes, and rivers of the earth would be unrecognizable to us now. At the end of the last ice age, around 14,000 years ago, climate change began to melt the vast ice sheets of the Northern Hemisphere, causing mega floods. The Caspian Sea rose more than 50 metres. That's over 160 feet. As it continued to rise, it spilled over, flooding into the Black Sea. These two seas were once connected by a massive waterway, and I believe it's the trading link described in legends as the River Phasis. So from around 12,000 BC, it was possible to sail from Greece, across the Black Sea, and on to the east, just as Homer described.
Now, the timing of these mega floods is still hotly debated. But what's important for us is the connection between the seas likely remained open till around 6000 BC. And that is a game changer.
You are very brave. ancient Greek tale of Jason and his brave Argonauts could have originated thousands of years earlier than we think, with the first people to sail across this ancient waterway. We're pulling into shore because there's a very special place I want to see, a short distance out of town. This is a site that's so ancient, it's older than the Jason myth. It dates back to the very first seafarers to ever set foot here.
This is Sesklo. I'm just a couple of kilometres away from where the Argo's anchored. But 9,000 years ago, this was a Neolithic settlement. And why it's so special is because this is where Eastern seafarers first landed in Greece. And from here, the Neolithic Revolution spread all over Europe.
In the Neolithic era, a revolutionary change in human civilization was taking hold. People left the nomadic lifestyle and began to farm. Now they could rely on a stable source of food, and this in turn gave them the freedom to travel. Archaeologists refer to it as the Great Exodus. In a series of voyages between 7 and 6,000 BC, pioneering seafarers sailed westwards from the coasts of Turkey and Syria across the eastern Mediterranean all the way to Greece.
What's so significant for us is the place where these seafarers settled, right here, is exactly the same place that the Jason legend begins. I believe the story of Jason and the Argonauts is far older than we've ever believed. I think it originates with those seafarers.
So instead of being a Bronze Age tale told only 3,000 years ago, I'm convinced the legend of Jason and his Argonauts began with the true story of pioneering Neolithic mariners who migrated across the world when the seas were connected. And there's a remarkable record of Neolithic seafarers that survives today. This is a pictograph of a Neolithic sea vessel scored into the rocks of Gobustan, over 2,000 kilometres to the east in Azerbaijan. These are boats with keels. Some have as many as 37 oarsmen. They suggest that Neolithic seafarers had developed the technology needed for long-distance marine navigation. So they could have travelled and traded between east and west. For all this to be feasible, there must be some evidence that the waterway linking these seas, the legendary Phasis River, actually existed. Like the Neolithic mariners, I'm heading from Greece across the Black Sea to southern Russia. Water levels have dropped by as much as 75 metres. That's nearly 250 feet. But I believe that a remnant of the Phasis still survives. It's known as the Manych Waterway. It runs for over 600 kilometres, almost all the way to the Caspian, in a chain of lakes, streams and boggy wetlands. This is a conservation area, and I've jumped on board a Parks and Wildlife boat to explore. When water levels here were higher, these rivers and marshes were part of the immense Phasis waterway.
What's truly remarkable is that after 8,000 years, Kazakhstan and the Russians are planning to reopen it in a series of canals and dikes. They're going to actually connect the seas again. And once again, you'll be able to sail from the Black Sea through to the Caspian.
Just like the Russians today, The ancient Greeks had the same idea. Very likely inspired by the myth of Jason, Alexander the Great believed that once an ancient connection between the seas had existed. And in 282 BC, a Macedonian general named Patrocles was ordered to search the Caspian Sea to find out if it was still possible to sail between east and west. Patrocles' report reveals that he reached the point where the Manych waterway begins today. Here, he would almost certainly have seen all that remained was a series of streams and marshes. In an astonishing series of conquests, Alexander expanded the Greek Empire all the way to the borders of India. Like his mythic hero Jason, Alexander found immense riches in eastern lands. He realized to make his new empire work, he had to transport these lucrative goods back to Greece. The answer was to create a shipping route. Even though the river Phasis no longer flowed, Patrocles still had to find a connection between the Caspian Sea and the trade routes of India. Greek records tell us that Patrocles found a way to sail from the Caspian to Central Asia's mightiest river, the Oxus, a waterway that flowed thousands of kilometers to the east. Like Patrocles, I'm now heading to the southeastern shore of the Caspian in modern Turkmenistan to find the ancient connection to the River Oxus. The problem is, today, the Caspian and the Oxus are far from connected. They're separated by almost 700 kilometers of desert. Water levels have dropped so much that today it's a completely different world.
Is this all sand dunes out here?
Yeah.
And how far does that go?
Around 180 kilometers.
I want to reach the point where the Caspian ends today. For the next month, Bava will be my guide and interpreter of all things Turkmen.
He said that just take this road.
And so that's where he says that, the water finishes
yes.
there. Well, this is probably as far as it comes. Can we stop here, Gooch? This looks right. Well, this whole place is all salt. It's what's left of the ancient sea. But over here is where the Caspian comes to an end, or at least it's how far east it travels today. So that poses an incredible riddle, because according to the ancient Greeks, they were able to sail right across here and up to the Oxus. So the riddle is, what happened to the river?
The Greeks describe a vast waterway where trade from the Oxus could be transported to the west. It's hard to imagine that this barren, salty landscape was once a busy and fertile shipping route. To prove that Patrocles' journey was possible, I need to find a trace of the ancient riverbed. Our search leads us into one of the most extreme places on Earth, the Karakum Desert. Summer temperatures can reach 52 degrees Celsius. In the depths of winter, they plummet to a bone-freezing 40 below. This is virgin territory for all of us. According to Bava, no outsiders, and few locals even attempt crossing this sea of sand.
Well, if it looks a bit deeper, a bit sticky, the mud.
Yeah.
Do you think we should turn around?
I think so. You know, it might rain or two, so let's not take a risk.
We're following the dry and broken bed of a river that today is called the Osboy. Could it once have been a branch of the mighty Oxus Delta that Patrocles recorded? 200 kilometres into the desert, and the Osboy is starting to show signs of water flow.
Looks like a moonscape, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Incredibly barren and very, very lonely.
Tracking the river's course from higher ground is too difficult, so Barber's arranged a more traditional mode of transport. Friend Tolly has agreed to take us out on horseback so we can get down to the Osboy bed and explore.
If you're wondering why Tolly's actually putting on a costume, it's not for us, it's not for show. It's so traditional here that they couldn't bear the thought of actually getting on a horse without looking like a Turkoman warrior. There's a saying right here all throughout this country that paradise is on the back of a horse.
Locals like Tolly are known as the Atili, people of the horse. They're quite possibly descendants of the ancient settlers that came here when this was a verdant water world. The rest of the team will follow with all the gear, food and water in this monster. A Russian Kamaz, without a doubt, one of the toughest vehicles ever made. In this barren and desolate region, there's a ruin that stands as a monument to ancient river culture. This is the only substantial fortress to be unearthed on the broken watercourse of the Osboy. It was part of a settlement called Igdikala, and it was built around 200 AD, 500 years after the voyage of Patrocles.
It's like it was yesterday. It's amazing that probably a good-sized town lived in this place, whether it was a place where there was taxes collected by water traffic or whether it was completely dry here and it was actually caravans coming through. It shows you how climate change can totally change a place. People could not live here today. It's far too dry and there's no water. It's all salt water.
It's all that remains of a once thriving ancient city. Perched on high ground, Igdi would have been perfectly placed to guard the flow of people and trade. But the very presence of this fortress town suggests that even after the time of Patrocles, water levels here were still far higher than they are today. In the time of the ancient Greeks, the Oxus was a mighty floodway, as wide as the Egyptian Nile. The problem is, the Osboy is a slow meandering river. These gorges are just 100 metres across at their widest points. That's only 300 feet. The Oxus would have been at least five times as wide. So there's just no way the Osboy could be the river connection I'm looking for. We've travelled over 350 kilometres across the Karakum Sands. And we're going to spend another freezing night in the desert.
Hey,
thank you. Oh, it's fantastic. Basically, it's a whole sheep, boiled, and this is the juice. And it's fantastic. It's cold outside, and this is really warm. And the vodka is helping.
Vodka is best.
Vodka is best.
Chin-chin.
This has always been a land rich in resources. This fiery crater is seeping natural methane gas. It was ignited only 40 years ago, but it's earned the name Gate to Hell. In ancient times, sailors like Patrocles could use this kind of geographical landmark to navigate. And these extraordinary natural phenomena inspired Greek legends. Aristotle would have told Alexander of the gods and monsters believed to have roamed the lands of the East. I believe somewhere in this mysterious, deserted terrain are signs of the ancient Oxus River Delta that Patrocles described. The vital link in Alexander the Great's vision of a shipping route between East and West. There's one forgotten theory that could hold the key. In 1898, Ellsworth Huntington, professor of geography at Yale University, analyzed the fluctuation of the Caspian. He declared that the Osboy was not a river at all, but part of an estuary. Water levels were still so high in the time of the ancient Greeks that the Caspian and the Aral Seas were larger than they are today. And the terrain between the seas would have been covered with water, making a series of vast wetlands. Huntington's theory helps explain how Patrocles was able to sail east from the Caspian into the great delta of the Oxus. After 10 days of trekking through some of the most inhospitable terrain on Earth, we find what we've been looking for. But I was completely unprepared for the grandeur of the ancient shore. Standing here, it's clear that this was once the edge of a great inland sea.
So, if this theory is correct, what it means is that the sea level, all the way from the Caspian, right through to here and to the Aral, was much higher. Now, where I stopped up there is 250 feet. And that's where they reckon that the sea level got to. So this place was an inland waterway. And the Greeks, according to this theory, could have sailed right past here.
Years ago, this would have been a maze of river channels and countless reed beds. A bountiful wetland, just as Patrocles and the Greeks reported. I've heard that to the north lie the ruins of a magnificent city, settled by the Persians around the time Alexander travelled east. It's clear to see that the city was built on the edge of a headland and would have dominated the waterfront. This is the great fortress of Devkesen. Today, Devkesen lies right on the Turkmenistan-Uzbekistan border in no man's land.
The trench is from the border, is it?
It's off limits, but amazingly, Bava gets us through. Being able to enter this fortress is a first, even for him.
That's an old defensive wall out there. This is a city in here.
The city's built upon a 30-meter high escarpment. It was protected from attack by a system of moats and defensive walls that lead back through the city entrance to the central citadel, or Arg.
Have you ever seen a gate or an entrance like this anywhere? It's quite incredible. It's the shape of a battle axe or a semicircle. That would have been one drawbridge and one moat. And then over here, there's a whole nother moat. Another drawbridge would have taken you into the city.
You can sense the ancients here. A place of such obvious prosperity must hold so many stories of life, death, and ultimately, collapse. The first settlers would likely have been followers of an ancient monotheistic religion called Zoroastrianism. But this shrine dates back to more recent medieval occupation and the arrival of Islam 900 years ago. As the wetlands upon which the city depended dried up, Devkesen's eventual demise was inevitable.
Well, I'm absolutely blown away by this place. It is magnificent, and particularly because it hasn't been robbed. Basically, as far as archaeology is concerned, it's intact. But if you could imagine what this place was like, people lived here from about 400 BC, perhaps earlier, all the way through to about 1550, 1600. Now, this would have been an enormous gate into the central arch where the Khan would have lived. And behind me, on the top there, would have probably been originally a Zoroastrian burial site. But really, this is an amazing fortress.
But Devkesen is not alone. Along this ancient sea coast, are more than half a dozen ruined cities and citadels. And like Devkesen, all of them are built on high ground. The signs are everywhere of a massive drop in water levels.
Well, this is quite a hole in the ground, this. Wow. I think, quite obviously, at the well. And I don't really want to actually topple into it, because if I have a look down, well, it's a good 30 meters. And what it is an amazing indicator of what these people went through over the centuries, because it probably started at where the water level was much higher. It's quite shallow. And then as the water has shifted away and drained away, they've had to tunnel and tunnel. And it's a hell of a long way. This would have had a huge contraption above it with donkeys pulling up big buckets of water, which would have been the water for the whole city. It's an incredible thing to have remaining. Usually these get filled in quite quickly. This one's completely intact, and it's quite marvelous. And there's something down there. Woo, here he comes. Hey.
The story of the lost city of Devkesen is a century-by-century gauge of the radical climate change that happened here. What's remarkable is that the very same thing is taking place today. We're heading even further north in the wake of the ancient Greeks into the former Soviet Union, modern-day Uzbekistan. I'm looking for the coast of the Aral Sea, and 60 years ago, this wasn't desert, but seabed. Just two generations ago, Fishing fleets harvested great shoals of fish here. Like the aftermath of a tsunami, the last of the Aral fishing fleet lies scattered, like children's toys in the sand. But here the end was not caused by the sudden impact of an enormous wave. The people of the Aral literally watched their livelihoods slowly ebb away. We finally make out the grey blue of the seashore. This coastline has retreated by almost 100 kilometres. With no rainfall to speak of, the Aral relies exclusively on the waters of the ancient Oxus and the Jarxes. But these rivers have been so depleted by the impact of Soviet irrigation schemes that hardly a drop reaches the Aral shores. It ranks as one of Earth's greatest environmental disasters. Today, this sea is on the brink of extinction.
According to my GPS, it's about 54 feet above mean sea level. That's about 16 metres. Now, that's an incredible change from the 1960s, when the sea level was 100 feet higher than where I'm standing. What's also incredible, it's incredibly cold. It's about minus 2 degrees. My hands are absolutely numb, and operating this thing is quite difficult.
Patrocles records the distance from here to the Caspian, but makes no mention of the Aral Sea. Water levels here were so high, the Aral was part of a connected waterway.
What for me is amazing is that 2,500 years ago, the sea level was actually 200 feet higher. At the time of Alexander, this whole area was inundated. So what it means is our climate, particularly this area, has been very, very changeable over thousands of years, much more changeable than we've ever thought.
Like Patrocles, we've travelled across the Caspian all the way to the Aral Sea. Now we're heading south towards Afghanistan to reach the Oxus River. In the time of the ancient Greeks, it would have been a leisurely sail from here to the Oxus Delta. But for us today, it's a 300-kilometre drive. After 2 weeks of desert travel, we're about to reach our goal. When the Greeks arrived, they found the heart of a civilization that was already more than 2,000 years old.
Well, this is it, the Oxus. What they called the great parent stream of humanity. And it was supposed to have rocked the cradle of our race. Now today, it still flows 2,500 kilometres from the roof of the world almost to the Aral Sea. It is one of the world's great rivers.
Today, it disappears not far from here in 1,000 irrigation canals. But in the time of Patrocles, this river was in full flow. He'd succeeded in his mission. Patrocles confirmed that just as Alexander had imagined, this great river did carry trade from India through Central Asia to the Caspian Sea. Now I want to cross the river to find out more about the Oxus civilization the Greeks discovered here. These Turkmen are on a cattle drive, and they're heading for the same place we are, a ferry boat. Today, only half a dozen of these old Soviet-era ferries operate along the river. The traffic slowly died as the Oxus trade diminished. countries and borders changed, and roads and vehicles spread.
Well, barges like this have been going up and down the Oxus for a long time. Right through the Soviet period, you could actually sail from the Aral Sea. Today, that's not possible. But in the Greeks' time, this river would have been full of traffic.
Nowadays, these ferry crews are among the last of the Oxus rivermen, a tradition that stretches back to the Greeks and beyond. Long ago, the Oxus was an ancient highway, with thousands of settlements, citadels, and fortresses spread out across its tributaries. And there's one place, now deep in the desert, that straddled this system over 4,000 years ago. These are the ruins of the city of Gonur. In its heyday, it was a huge trading center in a series of Bronze Age states that stretch for over 100 kilometers along the Oxus Valley. Discovered in 1972 by Soviet archaeologist Viktor Sarianidi, this city footprint has changed the way we think about the ancient world. Even today, it's clear to see Gonur's maze of streets. It's an extraordinary experience to stroll through the alleyways of a city that was flourishing in the Bronze Age, over 1,500 years before the arrival of Alexander. The people that lived here fired ceramics in kilns, grew grain, and raised livestock. Archaeologists have even found traces of a sophisticated irrigation system. And what's really amazing is the city's layout. A rectangular settlement enclosed by powerful defensive walls and semicircular bastions. Gonur was an imperial city. Inside its fortified palace complex were royal living quarters and funeral chambers. These excavations reveal that, like ancient Egypt, royal tombs were filled with golden treasures and animals to sustain them in the afterlife.
Well, Baba tells me that this is most likely the king's horse because it's buried just next to his burial chamber. And it just shows you for how long the horse has been revered in this land. Almost 5,500 years. I guess nothing's really changed here.
Gonur was a major commercial center, comparable to ancient cities in Egypt and the Indus Valley. It seems like it sprung from the desert, but thousands of years ago, there was water all around.
Well, once, this was actually full of water. This was probably the king's reservoir. And this was a filtration system that took the mud out of the river or the canal water, so it was pure. But then something went radically wrong, and this place was abandoned.
Gonur and its sister cities vanished just as mysteriously as they'd appeared. So how can this all be explained? How could a civilization simply appear, thrive for 500 years or more, and then just as mysteriously disappear?
Really, that's just another example of just how fragile human society really is. These places thrived, and then they were turned to dust. Conquering armies like Alexander may have sped up the process, but really, it's been the environment that's decided the fate of mankind.
Behind the demise of Gonur lies the extreme climate change that altered the course of the Oxus.
The whole place is covered in salt.
Wow. Well, this is incredible. This is an ancient lake. Now, my GPS has brought us here and it's confirmed the research that I've been doing. Basically, all the way from Afghanistan right through here to the Caspian is a low depression. Now, I think it's the bed of the ancient river. Because all of these lakes actually were once full, and carbon dating has shown that 3,000-5,000 years ago, this was actually a huge swampland. When it had too much water, or the river changed course, it came through here, flooded these lakes, and this was an entirely different world.
Through the ages, the changes in the course of the Oxus have been so volatile, locals named it Jehun, the crazy river. This is my last night with Barber and the guys. Without them, I wouldn't have been able to even attempt this journey, following the trail of ancient pioneers who crossed the globe when this was a water world.
So it was the Oxus, the Jehun, the crazy river, that determined how civilizations developed here. The river changed its course, destroying one civilization and giving birth to another. An incredible river in this amazing land.
In the time of Alexander, the Greeks ventured into a lost world. Along the Oxus, they discovered a forgotten Bronze Age culture so magnificent it rivaled any on Earth. The Greeks were inspired by the legend of Jason and the Argonauts to search for a shipping route between the East and the West. Empedocles' extraordinary mission proved that once, the Oxus did indeed flow through to the Caspian. Today, all that's missing is the water. But far from the end of our journey, this is just the beginning. Changing sea levels and disappearing rivers are not all the Greeks tell us. Intriguing accounts of Alexander's conquests in Persian territory lead us to the fabled city of Bactra, that today lies across the border in Afghanistan.
One of the problems about exploring places like this is these areas are full of landmines.
A place where ruined fortresses, settlements and age-old infrastructure still survive. Echoes of a lost culture that thrived here long before the rise of ancient Greece.
This would be one of the rarest things you could find here. It's probably something like 3,500 BC.